perhaps. Let's bring this day to an end with what's billed as a round table, but I think will probably be better played as a discussion session. So I'm going to limit my role really to just to introducing and highlighting some of the most important topics that we've been addressing today. I thought, however, though, I would begin somewhat tangentially by talking very briefly about a conference that I attended in May in Berlin, which was entitled, which was organised rather by a research centre called Episteme or In Motion, in other words, concerned with knowledge. And the conference itself was entitled What is an Academy? Early Modern Learned Societies in a Transcultural Perspective. It raised a number of interesting questions. But I think it's fair to say, well, two things. First of all, that the majority of the contributors to the conference were still working in really quite traditional ways. And from my point of view, that was somewhat disappointing because they were not actually engaged in the collection and codification of data in the way that we've been reflecting on here. So in a sense, there is a community of scholars out there that needs still to be drawn into this kind of world. That's not to to downplay traditional research. I mean, obviously, most of us, if not all of us, started there. But I think that the collection of data is one of the ways in which this question that they raised, what is an academy, can be answered, and I think we've seen some of that in some of the comments that have been made in the course of the papers. It was also the case, in fact, that of the papers, only two really addressed this question head on, that's to say, what is an academy, my own, which I won't talk about, and that of Françoise Vaquer, whose work some of you will know quite well, and whose paper was actually, I think, very interestingly entitled Qu'est-ce qu'une académie? Des gens qui parlent. And her main focus was indeed on the oral dimension and the way in which orality and all that goes with it, really, is what academies are about. That raises, again, of course, questions of definition, because we've also reflected here on the word conversazione, and whether such groupings can be seen as academies. But out of those two papers, that's to say hers and mine, what came through clearly were some of the issues that have also concerned us today, that's to say the question of orality and both as a means of defining academies and as a central activity of academies, and how we then proceed to study that, identify that, as it were, get at the sources for that in all its various manifestations, and the importance of archives and manuscripts in taking us beyond what the printed word tells us about academies, and thus enhances and elaborates much further work that has already been done, particularly within the Italian Academies project. So leaving aside Berlin and all its works, the key points, it seems to me, that have come out of these the discussions today turn around, as in the sense the programme establishes, archive and manuscript material that needs to be addressed in the study of early modern culture, and in our case more particularly the academies, how we do that, where the sources are, how we also codify it, the whole question of orality, which relates of course to that, and how we construct digital resources which can not only serve our needs now, but also how they can be developed and sustained in the future. And the real question, it seems to me, that we might reflect on at the end of the day is how to bring all these issues together, or more particularly how to plan to carry them forward. How do we reconcile archive research and the digital presentation thereof? How do we set about not only investigating the networks that existed in early modern Europe, but also the networks that might serve our research, in other words, collaborations across countries and across institutions, and very crucially, of course, where the funding is going to come from to do anything of all of this. And I think that one of the issues that I feel is still very much preoccupies me, and this was touched on just before we broke before this session, the question of longer term maintenance and sustainability after the end of a funding period, and the kind of guarantees that one looks for both when starting out and how much they can be defended further down the line. And it seemed to me, thinking about this actually last night as I reflected on the programme today and what we might be thinking about, and this is something that is not at all easy, but there is in a way a need for political action about the whole question of funding, unless we are fortunate enough to go to a grant awarding body like Mellon. Because if we take the case of the Italian academies, large sums of public money went into the creation of this resource, and large sums of money go into the operations, shall we say, of the institution which currently houses that database. But there's a kind of disjunction between these two outpourings of public money, or between what we might call the academic and research stance, in other words, the creation of that database, and the other strategies, the strategies of public repositories and even of funding bodies, which are not necessarily, of course, in any way the same. They may be aligned at the beginning of a period, but then diverge for perfectly good reasons, but not, of course, in the end, for the benefit of the public who have actually, in the end, largely paid for them. So I'd like, in opening up the discussion, to suggest that we focus a little bit on perhaps on the creation of resources, the complexities of them, which have been well demonstrated, I think, today, and also on the sustainability of them and how we might set about thinking about that in perhaps a larger perspective than just our own research perspective. There's also the question of definitions. This was something that did come up in the Berlin conference and was not really resolved, as you are not surprised to learn, I'm sure. But I think that we know that we have many different definitions here of an academy, but I think, as I said actually in Berlin, we need parameters. You can't actually bring everything in, and therefore at some point, with however many regrets, you do need to draw the boundaries, and I think I'd like, in fact, to stress that. And it's those boundaries perhaps need to apply not only to the definitions of what we are studying, but also what kind of documents we might bring into a repository, how many libraries or institutions we might wish to engage with, how many countries. There are all sorts of areas which need focusing on. In order to be sure that that valid research can actually be done without everybody getting lost in some kind of endless labyrinth. And I think, if I can come back to Alessio's point, the step-by-step approach is certainly one that commends itself, I think. The other point, I think, that comes out of all that we've been reflecting on is that collaboration needs to exist not only, as it were, between countries or groups of researchers, but within a research team itself. I mean, we already had, for the Italian Academies project, a range of different specialisms, but they were all still, in a certain sense, within one kind of academic formation. But if you open up, as the indications of today suggest, to archives, then you need people who know how to read archives. If you're going to bring in manuscripts, you need people who are trained in reading manuscripts, not just from the point of view of handwriting, but how to deal with them. And so one needs to think, I think, about how to build a team of people who perhaps come from quite different backgrounds in order to address the research questions of the future. I'm going to stop there and suggest that we perhaps focus a little bit on these sort of key terms that it seemed to me it came up, the whole question of archives and manuscript and oral sources, and the question of what kinds of digital platforms and how, you know, how they might operate. And you know, if you have questions arising out of papers that you didn't have time to ask, of course, the speakers are still here and will handle. Can I turn a moment to you, Filippo, since you're, as it were, our archive man?
Well, I don't know.
You know, how would you see, for example, from the sort of research and data collection point of view, archives being kind of gathered into projects such as the Italian Academies? I mean, given that, as you and others have said, these archives are very scattered, there is a time constraint involved in mm-hmm. finding them.
Well, I think it seems to me that I come to this with, you know, no previous knowledge of where you might think that this might be going, but it seems to me that the potential is immense and that you can have different people at different levels in their career, from PhD students to, you know, year abroad undergraduates to postdocs and, you know, more senior researchers, working on different kinds of material in different locations on different archives. I'm very keen on what I heard from the combined session of Lorenza and Lisa on linking, you know, I'm not a historian of academies, but as a historian of communication and early modern culture and urban culture in particular, I'd be very keen to see, you know, a greater number of manuscripts and sources keyed into the database that refer to activities of academies. And I mean, if I may say that, actually, I think Lisa made a very good distinction between printed and manuscript sources, where printed sources sort of present a facade and manuscript sources do. And we all know, you know, that this, you know, this is more complicated, you know, also manuscript sources are also meant for circulation and, you know, like Zazzera's diary and so on. But it is true that the Italian Academy's database as it is now presents this wonderful network of people and their publications, and, you know, you can connect them. But it'd be great to know really what they did.
Yes.
You know, more about their activities, more about the conversazione, more about the sociability, more about the, you know, formal and informal practices tied to academies.
Would you see? So, would you see that? I mean, if we take the sort of model of the, you know, the kind of, well, both of the models that were talked about with you know, epistolary matters in them. I mean, if for the sake of argument, leaving aside exactly what it might look like, if the Italian Academy's database had transcriptions of letters, unpublished letters, I mean, manuscript letters, with perhaps a commentary of some kind as to, you know, what connects these two people or whatever. Would that in a sense...
Absolutely. Yeah. This is what I say. I should have been clear by saying that, you know, adding records, documents relating to interactions between people, you know, letters is a typical example, but you can think of, you know, many other kinds of, but yes, that would be great. And, you know, I understand why you want to set boundaries, but I think, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover before
boundaries. I think the boundaries would need, well, to some yes, I mean, this is perhaps where the question of definitions becomes problematic, because, as you say, I mean, we might say, give ourselves a definition of an academy, but then precisely some of the information about you know, what links people or why they're doing something or, you know, what kind of activity they've been, may come from some group, as it were, some kind of institution that we have excluded because it's not an academy, but it actually provides information into, as it were, the academy system. And that, so then, you know, one has to have, I mean, in a sense, the IAD already has some fluid boundaries because if you look at it, that, you know, the 1700 deadline is not quite as you know, fixed as all that. And similarly, as Simone was pointing out at the beginning, you know, that 1525 has been pushed back, you know, to take account of the Academia Andina. I suppose this is where I think there is a further discussion to be had around the name Academy, because, I mean, again, some of the discussions we've had today have been talking more about what you might call scholastic institutions as opposed to cultural, simply cultural gatherings. And again, I mean, that is a distinction that I would draw, but on the other hand, as was well demonstrated, the people involved in these more scholastic academies, that's to say school-type things, not medieval scholastic, were also the same people who were involved in the more cultural, sort of social gatherings. And so, you know, the information that one might be seeking about their activities might in fact be, as it were, you know, in one of these other academy. So I think, you know, there's a sense in which one probably needs to set boundaries, but nonetheless be prepared to go beyond them in order to find the information to fill up, you know, what you're producing.
I think the letters in the Medici or del Principato and the Miscellanea, and it's now a lot clearer, I think, to all of us. Thank you. Thanks to Alessio. They could, I'm sure that, you know, in fact, you showed one of your tags or one of your keywords is academies, and if they could be tied, Tuscan ambassadors in various Italian cities or capitals describing academies, if they could be tied in, you know, why not? You showed the beauty of visualizing these networks that can expand and thicken. And then, of course, you know, the question is what we do with it. But another question. But let's start by connecting all these documents. So that would be my reaction. My first reaction, maybe I can think something more meaningful.
Yes.
Well, I thought one of the things that was quite interesting that came out was the different typologies of documents as well that were associated with academy. So if we're starting to think about, you know, how would you start by populating? And I think, you know, that they came out different. Obviously, the name, the terms that are used are different. Even for the Medici archive, we use various different terms, I guess, over time they change. But I think Luca's presentation mentions the academy books, as it were, and then the other things like letters and dialogues we had and other things that were sort of related to academies. And I think that, you know, already sort of, I think that was quite interesting way of thinking, you know, what is, I mean, did academies themselves have archives rather than, you know, how we are archiving academies, but also thinking about the kinds of things, the inventories you were talking about, and academies had those. They had libraries in some cases. And I think, you know, in a sense, we could reconstruct similarly that from thinking about what is an academy archive per se, and the operation that we're doing sort of backwards, as it were, to try to reconstruct also from other kinds of sources, archival manuscripts and visual. I mean, those are the other things that there were a lot of material. I think that all those kind of questions that Luke had to raise is that there would be even ways of doing that beyond just simply the manuscript and the archival as well. But I suppose finding a way to start, those are kind of questions.
The example you showed, Matthew, of Gabriel Harvey's books that are now scattered around the world, but used to be in his library, wherever that was in a room somewhere
in Essex.
Yes. Cannot now be brought back together, but they can digitally. That is surely something that can be done, for academies. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I imagine that. I mean, these are the questions I was asking this morning. You know, if you know, as a historian, not some academies certainly did have archives. Mm. You know, you don't have to think of millions of letters. We have archives. You know, we have utility bills filed in a drawer, more or less, or tidily, and some academies would have put greater thought into how to arrange and use maybe even embellish these records than others, and that would be interesting to assess.
I think. You build your identity by building your archive, and this is very, very important, very useful for an academic group that want to be memorized by the public. So I think we have also to think about how building archive is an instrument to build identity.
Well, the Medici kind of take hold of rather than create.
Or the Vatican example. Or
yes.
Like that. But so I wonder if anyone has.
Well, that was where.
Why is this academies that's emerging, and how does it compare to your.
Well, to answer your second question, I mean, that was what I hoped might come out of this conference in Berlin, because there were people speaking about academies in a whole range of different places. Including, in fact, in India and in the Far East, which were mainly Jesuit academies, and again that raised the question of whether a Jesuit academy is.
Right.
I think that the most interesting country for comparison, probably with Italy, and which, in spite of where the conference was held, was not looked at very much, would be Germany with its myriad states.
But not 800.
Depends. What time scale you're taking. But I mean, if you run it into through the 18th century, you get to about 2,000 or something at Mailand, I think, codified. Not that many, but nonetheless, that would be the best comparison. I mean, there is quite a lot going on in France, but there's still. I mean, the work needs to be kind of. Started almost, I think. And then of course there is the question of things that are, again coming back to the like academies but don't call themselves that, or are academies but not doing the same thing as the Italian academies.
So am I wrong in thinking that the academies in the early 16th century are the first academies?
Well, Yes, I mean we have an ongoing dialogue with a colleague of ours in the Netherlands, who works on the chambers of rhetoric in the Low Countries, and who takes exception to the fact that we gave ourselves the subtitle of the first intellectual networks, because in his view the chambers of rhetoric are doing what the Italian academies are doing, but they have much less information. I mean, they know kind of where they existed. There's more information about the chambers in some places than in others, but they don't have the sort of data that we have already been able to collect, and which, you know, with time and individual, you know, kind of large enough team and so on, one could collect for the Italian academies, and indeed that Mailänder collected on his own. So it's hard actually to do much close comparison with those, because they don't have, for example, programs that, you know, even informal ones, if you like, that, you know, in this month the chamber debated this, or, you know, whereas
is it self-improvement, is it knowledge sharing, is it
identity? Well, for the Italian academies, I think
it's complicated,
yes, because it's all of those things. Plus, I think perhaps a reaction to you know, a century or so of, you know, really quite intense intellectual and cultural revival, or, you know, kind of innovation, or whatever you want to call, you know, the early Renaissance, combined, and what this was one of the reasons really why our project started from printing, combined with the impact of printing on the dissemination of knowledge beyond, you know, a small section of the population. I mean, that if you like, that's an explanation as to why the academies, and to some extent why the academies in Italy, because you mentioned literacy rates in Italy, which were much higher than elsewhere. And therefore, you know, there is a larger population able to engage with ideas once they are available. But nonetheless, I mean, over time, we've become more and more aware of the need to continue focusing on, handwritten exchange, because, you know, manuscript, and everyone thinks you're talking about beautifully decorated manuscripts and so on. But I mean, non-printed exchange, and indeed, going back to Françoise Vaquet's point, that the core of an academy's activities was often debate, lectures, reading, compositions, and performance of various kinds, so that, you know, the heart of what's going on is this sense of getting together to talk.
I mean, I think there is also, alluded to, but also, I mean, the fact that, you know, what's going on in universities, you know, where the knowledge practiced, and as you say, we have a very large literate population. Mm.
But not a debating forum.
A reaction. They do other things from the universities. I don't know. I'll look to our experts on the universities. But you know, some of the, obviously looking at new literature, looking at poetry, and looking at other kinds of activity, science, that new ways of doing science that were out, you know, that they couldn't have a natural forum perhaps in the universities. Sort of that also.
Yes.
I mean, that's another thing that came up in,
well,
you know,
which
in
a way,
yes.
So I think that censorship, so if they were working in a university environment where there might be censorship.
Yes, almost, yes. That's that, yeah.
And so it's a free space.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and
it's also states, right? I mean, there are some, you know, academies we wouldn't want to be a part of and group you're invited to.
Yeah.
And others.
Yes. Yeah.
Could I pick up on a different kind of point?
Yeah.
We've exhausted this one.
Yes. No, do please.
to go back to where Jane started about the way forward, and I just wanted to say a couple of things on the sort of more technology side about the way forward. One is, I don't usually disagree with Jane, but I think preaching to the unconverted is a complete waste of time. There are quite enough people doing digital research, and the important thing isn't to get more people to do it, it's to get people to do it well when they do it. And doing it well does mean, I think, using it to produce research knowledge that either you couldn't otherwise do or more normally, which would be much more difficult to otherwise do. But then your point about sustainability is a really important one. And particularly given what I was saying earlier about the practice of research council giving you the money in one go and then leaving you to keep it going otherwise. And there are some answers which at least mean that you can make the problem of sustainability easier to deal with. And I think there are basically two things that you have to distinguish. It's maybe trite for people here. You have to distinguish between the front end of a digital resource and the back end. The front end is the user interface and the back end is the data that you draw on. And what you have to make sure you do, I think, with regard to the back end, is to deposit separately in a form which makes it potentially reusable by other people at a later date. And you have to take certain steps to ensure that, but it's not all that difficult to do. So you ensure that your data is deposited in a form that requires minimum updating and can be then used again by other people later. Stick it in your UCL university repository to begin with, but in a form that makes it more easily reusable. Second point, I think, is that keep the front end simple. If you make front ends that are too complicated, especially if you use non-standard software, you run the real risk, don't you, that as the digital environment in which your resource is hosted is upgraded and updated, so yours will become unusable. So keep it so simple so that if you do have to update it, as you will have to do sooner or later, it's done fairly easily using software that your institution supports. So that's not going to solve the problem of sustainability completely, but it's going to help us solve it. And the last point, which other people have made, and I guess has emerged fairly clearly from the discussion we've been having, is that if you are creating large data resources these days, you really have to think in terms of open link data, don't you? And that's been behind an awful lot of the interventions that have been made there. But again, if you deposit your data in a form that's reusable, putting it in open link data form is not such a big deal. But open link data meaning put in a form which means it is usable by other machines than your own. And that's becoming a pretty standard requirement now, I think, and certainly for more funding.
Sorry, about the going back to the boundaries you were mentioning at the beginning. It seems to me, and also sort of continuing what Filippo said, basically, let's imagine that we go back to the original idea, which seemed very interesting, very good, in particular for the terminus ad quem, basically, not after 1700 when the Arcadia kind of starts populating the entire peninsula with its colonies, etc. It seems to me that if we keep that boundary into 1700, but we go backward to 1434, which is the first mention of academy as a place, at least, where scholars meet in an informal way to discuss things. We already have a lot to do in order to think about creating a digital archive dedicated to not only books but manuscripts, oral representations, visual representations, and also improving, for instance, the full display page related to individuals, where we can actually record more details, such as, for instance, their place, whether they were, in case they had a place in the local university or not, as it was normally the case, and also make these fields more related. We can click on, let's say, university lecturer, right? And we can have a more integrated database. it seems to me that we have already a lot to sort of basically to cover, and then in further articles, monographs, miscellanies, etc., we can then give interpretations to what we are finding, and I think that we will be able to find a lot of information more, especially also given the relational database that Vittorio Casarosa has tried to show what the potentials of it, basically. We still need to populate what we already have there.
Yes.
The problem is that we have to escape the prison of the British Library. I mean, this is the core issue at the moment. I mean,
well,
we are stuck for four years since we can't
in terms
really
of further development, yes.
Yeah,
because
we can't add any...
Except that it is now... I mean, there are now the downloadable XML files, which can be worked on. I mean, I haven't tried to do it, but so that in that sense, you know, one of the points that David's raised has fortunately been taken care of. That's to say, we do now have the raw data, and that presumably will also be maintained by the British Library, since they've just done it and put it onto their digital humanities platform. I think that any future plans that we might have for what we've already done, the XML files are not very kind of, in that sense, not very user friendly. I mean, the data is there, but they don't depend on where we then take that stuff and how it gets reconfigured. Which obviously raises a whole lot of questions about, are we going to, for the sake of argument, extend backwards in time, which, has certain logic, if you like. But do we want to do that and expand the number of centres, to take in Milan?
Yes.
And, can one think of doing both of those things, or should we focus on one or the other, in the step-by-step approach that, that Alessio has been recommending? So I think I think that and much depends really on where we take where the database migrates to, and if it goes to the Medici Archive project, how MIA develops and how our database is then reconfigured to fit with that, may then point in certain directions, where to go next with our collection of data and the questions we're asking of it and so on. But I think the other thing to bear in mind, and in a sense coming back to David's point about what are we doing that could not have been done or would have been done with much more difficulty, I think it's fairly clear that the work that we've done makes it easier to work on a lot of the Italian academies, even if it could have been done in the past with more kind of time and effort. But nonetheless, I think as in the case of the second project, when we were both continuing to develop the database and do independent research on it, that ought to be equally, it ought to be a kind of a dialogue in a sense between collecting data and interrogating it and producing new questions and the new research that arises out of it. And it seems, and I think, if the focus shifts somewhat perhaps from printed material to manuscript archive and kind of oral sources, then that will in fact generate some new research. Well, I'm sure it'll generate some new research, but also some new research questions, which will very much enrich our understanding of the academies. And I think, it is that sort of work which will allow us further to come back to the definition of what is an academy, beyond just, does somebody call themselves an academy? Because it will become clear from the sort of material collected, whether it's manuscripts, archives, more printed books, whatever, that there are activities that are those of an academy, whatever the institution is called or the society is called or whatever, it will help to clarify, I think, ideas about to answer in a sense the question, what is an academy, on the basis of perhaps of more evidence and a wider range of evidence.
Could I just pick up the small point there, which is that making these easier to do is awfully important. But I think the thing that comes across very strongly, it came across very strongly from Melissa's presentation, I think, is that what these things do is they may not usually allow you to do things and you couldn't possibly do them by yourself, but they do hugely facilitate collaborative work.
Yes, yes. And that's where I think the pattern of the Medici archive development is really very stimulating, because it implies exchange between people working at different levels and also the whole open world stuff, as it were, that is all about, as it were, sharing across the whatever you're working on. The only thing, the question I had actually coming back to your presentation was the kind of editorial control over what people are putting in. Not obviously, I mean, a scanned document is a scanned document, but you know, if somebody puts in a comment on a document, you know, where the control is about the accuracy of that.
Yeah, that was always a problem.
Yes.
I mean, when we had just the Medici Principato, and we had people entering. First of all, the way it started at the beginning, when we had the Access database, for every document that was entered. Transcription, summary, the selection of biographical entries. Another fellow would check it and would vet it.
Yeah.
And then, so for instance, by 2006, we had something like 15,000 documents. Potentially, we could have had 30,000 documents if someone did not vet. You know, that worked out well. I mean, you know, people were checking, but it was extremely time-consuming. And also, we had sort of a very superficial calculation of how much time it would take to do the entire thing. It was like 250 years. I thought maybe that we should limit it. So that was an issue. When you get to when you then we move to the next step, which is what we have right now, which is BIA, and it's much more manageable, because when people do enter documents, when they do transcribe and comment and summarize, we have a staff which looks at them. You know, which is you know, we have two or three people who, or I sometimes do too. Look at what, you know, the latest thing that's been entered in the database, and you pick up mistakes here and there, but not that often. Also, because we've only given possibility to a number of people to do this kind of operation. That is, you have to have, not everyone can do it. You have to get permission from us to do it.
To enter, yes. Right.
Because one can easily screw everything up and change names and, you know, mistake. When we get to the next step, which is really like, you know, and it's the community who decide. I mean, I've noticed that a lot of, you know, at the beginning when people, you know, the greatest example was Gravel. People confused Yanko with the, you know, and there was a lot of that confusion, you know, and people would say, it's not, you know, Antoine is the other one. You know, and then I would see the people would actually intervene, you know. And that's what triggered this idea of having some sense of freedom and liberty to give scholars some sense of liberty to do what they wish. But as a scholar, personally, I don't trust anything on BIA. I actually check the original, all the time. So that's why it's important to have the original.
Yes.
Because no matter who wrote it, especially. If I write the entries, if I enter this, I always double check three times, simply because that's before I publish, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's the point is always to do that. This is something that should, I mean, I hate saying this because it sounds sort of, again, superficial. This is something that should foment trajectories of research. When you actually get to the point of publishing things and putting them black on white. And you know, then it's something else. Then you have to. I mean, BIA started with the concept where people should go back to the archive, the real place.
Yes.
It was. We never thought for a nanosecond this could be the, you know, the substitute. You know, in lieu of the real thing. You get this. You know?
No.
The idea is to begin a research that then would end up in the real place. So in fact, it works because people want to go to the archive.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
That was the whole point behind it.
Yeah.
In terms of authority, we have to. We're trying to see how it works when we leave it to the
dogs. Okay. So it's
and then see what happens.
Watch the space.
Like a lot of things that we decided to do, we just tested them and see what happened.
Yes, and then you can introduce controls or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can I suggest
yes.
that we perhaps, since we've been talking about limits, watch this space, perhaps round up now and we can take our conversations further over a glass of wine.
Yes.
And I want to thank, first of all, Jane Emerson for chairing. It's very, I think, very stimulating. Close. Hopefully that won't be, it will be the starting point of something.
Well, I think, yes, from all of us, I mean, thank you to you for organising the day. And I think there's lots of food for thought. And start writing the next project.
Great. Can we thank the speakers and the chairs.